Welcome to the Sportsman Drag Racing Legends podcast, brought to you by the Class Racing Podcast with Aaron and Chuck. I'm your host, Mike Delahanty, and I'll bring you stories and conversations with some of the true legends of stock, super stock, and modified sportsman drag racing. This podcast is sponsored by Race Tools Direct. Race Tools Direct was founded to be your choice for quality tools and products that have been carefully selected and thoroughly tested, both at the track and the shop, by racers for racers. To place an order, go to racetoolsdirect.com or call 440-941-8533. This is Season 1, Episode 6. In this episode, I talk with Dave Bortman. Dave Bortman was one of the first touring professional sportsman racers. He is a five-time NHRA national champion with 17 NHRA national event wins and 17 IHRA national event wins. Dave was elected to the CarCraft All-Star team five times in both the stock and super stock categories. As a tribute to Dave's racing career, he has been inducted to four different Hall of Fames. These include the Michigan Motorsports Hall of Fame, East Coast Drag Racing Hall of Fame, West Michigan Sports Hall of Fame, where he is the only auto racing member, and the International Drag Racing Hall of Fame, where he and Bobby Warren are the lone stock and super stock members. Dave started following the NHRA circuit in 1966 with a K-Stock 59 Chevy powered by a 283 2-barrel with a 4-speed. That car took Dave to the NHRA Stock World Championship title in 1968. After Dave's early success as world champion in 1968, and after winning the Division III Stock Linear Championship in 1969-70, along with national event wins at York and Indy, he caught the attention of Gil Kirk, who owned the Rod Shop, and was putting together a super team to go racing with the Dodge division of Chrysler Corporation. In his first year with the Rod Shop team in 1971, Dave had his best year ever when he won more races than he lost. When asked what his secret to winning was, Dave said, "I wanted to win more than anyone. I always felt that the person who wanted to win the worst and worked the hardest at it was going to win. I was 7 days a week, every hour of the day. I was totally dedicated to it." After winning the 1977 NHRA World Finals in the Rod Shop Challenger, Dave took some time off from his frantic racing schedule. Gil Kirk called again in 1985 to invite Dave to come back to the Rod Shop team, this time driving a Pontiac Firebird Superstocker. And in 1985, Dave won his fifth NHRA World Championship title. Dave has a great outlook on his racing. For him, it wasn't so much about the money, but instead the recognition of what he accomplished. As he puts it, it was the pat on the back that made the difference. I had a chance to speak with Dave in early April while he was spending some time in Florida.
Dave, thanks a lot for joining into the Legends of Sportsman Drag Racing podcast. I'm happy that you're able to be down in Florida enjoying some time in the sun while the rest of us are hunkered down in our... I suppose you're hunkered down as too, but thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for calling.
So, as always, I like to get started and kind of understand how you got started, what excited you, what got you going, what really made you excited and turn into such a, an accomplished racer.
Okay, yeah, I started back in 1962. I hung around with a bunch of guys that they went to the drag races, and I never went to them. I'd gone to the drag races at the Nationals at in 58 in Detroit, and all I remember is getting sunburned and everything else. That was my first race, and my second race was about 4 years later. It was at Central Michigan Dragway. All my buddies went up there and talked me into going up there one weekend, and I went up there and looked like they were having a lot of fun. So I went back the next week and entered my car and raced it, and it was kind of fun, and I got a trophy for it, and I thought that was really a big deal. And unfortunately, that was a week before the end of the season, And so I had to wait till the next year to go back out there and try it. And I waited all winter, and then I went back out there, and lo and behold, it wasn't the fastest car in my class. So I had to go home and do a little work on my car and make it faster. And that's how I kind of got started, because I was racing on the street and getting a lot of trouble doing that. So I thought, well, there's a good place where I can go race and have fun and with my buddies and stuff like that, and don't have to worry about the cops coming around and nailing me. So that's kind of how I got started at Central Michigan Dragway. And then the same year, John Grimmins opened up a track down at Martin, Michigan, just north of Kalamazoo. I started going there and Martin, and then just racing locally, and the guys hung around there, you know, they were rooting me on and telling me I had to go race NHRA. I didn't know what NHRA was. So like four letters to me, but I didn't know what they did. But anyway, they talked me into going, and the first race I went to was, I believe it was at Columbus, Ohio. Yeah, it was Columbus, Ohio, because we left Martin the night before we went to Columbus to go to the points race. And I did good down there, so I started running the NHRA circuit.
And now, what kind of car were you running at that time?
59 Chevy.
It was the 59.
Yeah, I started out with the 59 Chevy 2-door third cup, and then I see that was a little heavy for the class, so I picked up a 2-door sedan, made it into just a race car, because the 59 Chevy was my driver, and you know, you couldn't do a lot of things to a driver and race it too, because well, it changed the gear and everything and all that stuff. So I just decided to dedicate a 2-door sedan to it, and it fell at the top of the class, and I was pretty successful in it.
Yeah, now was that a 283 2-barrel or 4-barrel car?
2-barrel car.
Okay, all right, okay. With 3-speed stick, right?
I started out with 3-speed stick, ended up putting 4-speed in it.
Okay.
Yeah, call the dealer, installed option, and you could do that, and that's when I started winning the races. I actually had the 4-speed, and the 3-speed was kind of doggy, and, you know, it couldn't do what the car that fit the class would do, you know.
So that was the 59. That was the yellow budget breaker car, right?
That's correct. Yeah, that's the one that was a dedicated race car. The original Impala was just my street driver, and I ended up just towing the 59 2-door behind the Impala. 59 okay. Pallet, you know, when I first started racing.
Okay. So what year was it that you really, I know, 68, you were the world champion, right, with the
yeah,
budget break?
That's correct.
And now, yeah. Before that, had you done anything like on a division, you know, division, because to get to the world finals, then you had to at least be one of the top points guys or qualify to get in?
Yeah, actually, I went out to Tulsa, Oklahoma in 67, with my 59 Chevy budget breaker, and it wasn't fast enough to qualify, so I knew that the next year if I was going to go out there, I had enough points to go.
Okay.
So, because I'd been running the division races, and I think that 67 was the first year I had enough points to go, and I went out there and didn't qualify. So I said, well, the next year I'm going to go out there, I'm going to be fast enough to qualify. So I got about enough points to go there again. The problem was that my car wasn't fast enough. So I talked to, I knew a guy that was racing, Tom Elk.
Yeah.
And he had a pretty fast car. And so I thought, well, he built motors. So I thought, well, I'm going to ask him if he wants to make a deal, you know, borrow his motor and put it in my car and see how fast it would go, so I could qualify.
Right.
So, make a long story short, I went out there with his motor in my car in 68 and qualified good, and he kept saying, oh, I don't know if you're going to be able to do it. You're going to not be able to do it. And I said, just don't worry about it, Tom. I said, I'll just drive these guys if I can't do nothing else. And so I ended up that I did, you know, and I raced Bill Isakowski with the Beast Soccer in the final.
Right.
And, of course, Beast Soccer out in Oklahoma, I mean, there was just no bite at all at that track.
Right.
It was horrible, but I had enough to win, and I didn't. I just went through doing like I did it all the time, you know, and I didn't get excited or nothing. I just kept doing what I had to do, and didn't even think I was going to win, but I got into the final and I did everything I did. I got there first and my wind light come on and I says, said to myself, I won. I won. I said, well, but nothing. I won. I'm the world champion. So it was pretty exciting, you know. So that's where it all started. So, and I raced that car again through 69. And then, of course, at 69, they were going to take the transmission away from me, the four-speed in 69. Right. But they didn't do that till 70 because I had won the world finals. And so they said, well, we'll just wait another year. Well, then by that time, I knew they were going to take the four-speed away. I said, I ain't going to run without a four-speed. And at the same time, I knew that with a four-speed car, I wasn't as consistent as I would have been with an automatic. So at that time, I decided to build a 69 Chevy with a 350 in it. I watched in 1969 at the U.S. Nationals. I can't remember his name. He was from North Carolina, had a stick in the Nova.
Was it Rowe that had one of those? Earl Rowe, or last name was Rowe?
Rowe, yeah. R-O-W-E. And yeah. I saw that. I sat in the stands and watched that in 69 and watched that car go down the track. And I said, I'm going to have one of those things. So I went and found the 69 Chevy with a 350 automatic in it. And because I had a dealings with Tom Elk, I had him build the motor for it.
Right.
And so we come out with that. At the time, I was living in Florida because I moved down there for the winter and do some racing. And,
yeah.
You know, trying to get some more seat time so I was more consistent. Did real good down there with the car ran really fast, and I won my division again with that car. I think that was the first year I won the division. Before that, I'd won enough that I qualified, but I don't think I won the division until 70, and at 70 I won the division with that 69 Biscayne.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then I also won the Nationals, U.S. Nationals in 1970.
That was a pretty big deal at that point.
Yeah, and what that did is I got Chrysler's attention. Okay, and Gil Kirk was trying to deal with Chrysler, and at the time I didn't know what was going on, but I found this all out later.
Right.
That Dave Kofel told him if he could get me on the, if Gil could get me on the team, he'd you know, look good, and he'd sign a deal with him.
Right.
So make a long story short, Gil Kirk called me up, and of course I knew about the rod shop because Tom Schumacher ran for the rod shop, and so I knew they had fast cars.
Yeah.
And so then I had an opportunity to not only race a Dodge for Chrysler, actually for the rod shop.
Yeah.
I mean, indirectly sponsored by Chrysler. Through the rod shop. So anyway, then I had the opportunity to do that. And of course, I was so excited about that I thought I just made up my mind that I was going to do the best job I could possibly do to figure where it would.
Yeah.
Well, consequently, in 1971, when I first raced with the Dodge in the rod shop, I won more races than I lost that year. So that's a pretty good record for a drag racer.
Yeah, so that was the combination of the white wagon and the blue Charger?
Yes.
Okay.
And then what happened then after 71 is they, NHRA decided that, you know, because I was a factory-sponsored racer, they didn't want no factory-sponsored racers in stock.
Yep.
So they made it so in 72, I could still run stock if I wanted to, but be for trophies, and that's it.
Right.
And I says, well, you know, I can't do that. You know, if I can't make enough money to support this habit that I've got, then I'm not going to do it because I've always made up my mind that I wasn't going to put any more money in than I absolutely had to, you know.
Right, right.
Because it's an expensive sport to be in. So I was trying to do it smart. So anyway, I was so excited to be sponsored that I really look forward to doing a good job for them. And I think that's what made me do a better job yet, you know, because I just felt privileged to be honored to do that. So And, one thing led to another. So consequently, when they did that, well, that's when they automatically put me into super stock for 72 because I wasn't going to race for trophies no more. That's why I've been ever since.
Right. And that's I guess, was a challenger in 72. Is that same 3v3 combination, right?
I raced the Charger in 71 okay. and 72 in 72 in super stock. 71 okay. in stock, 72 in super stock.
Okay.
Well, the Charger wasn't really a good car for super stock, so I decided to build a Challenger. And so that's how I happened to come into a Challenger. Because it had a shorter wheelbase, and, it ended with setback a little bit more than it was in the Charger. Charger had real long nose on it, so it had a lot of overhang at the front. So that's why we wanted to go with a Challenger, because it had better weight distribution and everything.
That 383 combination, I think you were the one, pretty much the only one at that time that really was running that thing, and it seemed to be a killer car.
What happened is, it's kind of funny because when I went down the rod shop and at that time I'd been building my own motors.
Right.
Farming out the machine work here and there and whatever. And so at that time I went to the rod shop and Dave Kofel says, well, we know what works for these cars, so this is the way you build a motor. I says, well, I looked at the way he wanted me to do it. I says, okay, if that's what you want me to do, I'll do it. I said, but I got some ideas of my own.
Yeah.
But so anyway, when I decided to build a motor, I built it their way. I had the rod shop build it their way, and I built another engine my way.
Right.
At the same time, well, not at the same time exactly. Through the year, I did that.
Yeah.
I built it their way first, okay, and then I decided, well, I can improve on this. So then I built another engine my way, and in the meantime, I fought that Cornet wagon back out. When I won the race at Pomona in 71 with it, I killed the record by 2,500. Marv Reitz was in the final with me. He killed his record by 2,900.
Okay.
He went
yeah.
400 quicker, and I got there first.
Yeah.
So, I at that time, they didn't have all the computers and all that stuff. So I just knew I always wanted to know where the red light was. And I'd
yeah.
back up a little bit from it. And that's the way I drove, Now these people nowadays with all the computers and stuff, they tell you everything. I figured all that stuff out by myself, So that's why that was pretty good at it because nobody else could figure it out, I guess.
Right.
Not like I did. Bobby Ward was close. He did a real good job. I had a hard time with him. He was very competitive. But I actually beat him more than he beat me, so that made me feel good.
Okay.
But I knew it was going to be tough every time I come against him. Anyway, getting back to the 383, I built the other motor, and then I put it in a station wagon. Well, when you figure it out, when I put it in a station wagon, it immediately went faster than I'd ever gone with the other motor in that car.
Right.
So, the Chrysler people said, well, you had the advantage. It's a wagon. It planted the tires harder. And they tell the old reasons why motor wasn't any better.
Yeah.
So, make a long story short, after running that way for several months, Dave Kofel says, why don't you try switching the motors in that car? So I switched them, and lo and behold, the motor I built was was faster than the motor Chrysler had me built. I bought about 1,500 here. When you switch cars, you can actually see, whatever you thought was just the car, you found out it was the motor.
Yeah.
So anyway, they ran two different classes, but, because of the weight. But anyway, he says, what'd you do different with that motor? I says, all I did is I built it set like a Chevrolet. he wanted to know everything I did and everything. And of course, I never told anybody everything I did because, some stuff you just don't tell.
Right.
So anyway, I raced that for a long time and the thing was, I had so much seat time, and then I used to go testing for Chrysler all the time, and then all kinds of stuff to test. I tested on my own.
Yep.
I was still under them. Okay.
Yeah.
So I did a lot of testing there with transmissions and all kinds of stuff. So, you know, they helped me a lot to go faster and faster, and then I had some things I did on my own, which I've still never told anybody. just because, you know, it's just, it's, I worked real hard for that, and I'm not willing to give it to anybody, you know.
Yeah.
And now they're all caught up with me because I was so far ahead of the people that they were. That's why it took me out of stock, is because I went way too fast, too soon, and, you know, it really hurt me because I liked to run in stock. I liked to run the better than super stock. I was always going to go back to stock, but never actually did it. You know, I was always able to be faster than anybody else, you know, with different things I did. And I was successful with what I did, you know.
That Challenger was, I mean, that car was really, really good to you.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that car, that car was actually, I actually had two Challengers. Nobody there knows this. But the first Challenger I got in 73. I just picked it up off the street, and we painted it just metallic blue and put vinyl stripes on it and raced it that year. And what nobody knew was that I had a body shipped to me on a pallet, a body in white. And, for a year and a half, we worked on making that car up for a race car. And that was what I finally ended up with. And when I came out with it in 74, you know, car was all painted. I said, "Oh, you got your car painted." I said, "Yeah." I said, "Got tired of that color. I want all that candy color back on there." So I just had it painted. Well, the other difference was my original, or that car, had a dark blue interior, and in the one that was body and white ended up with a black interior. Well, nobody ever caught that. So
okay.
Everybody always thought that was the same car. In 73, when I first raced it, it had a white vinyl top on it. So in 74, when it came out with the other car, they said, "Oh, you took your vinyl top off." I said, "Yeah, we didn't want to paint that car until we got the vinyl top off. We didn't have time to do it because we were racing it." So anyway, that story, everybody believed that story I told them. But it was actually a car that was really tricked up. It was built at the same time I was building that. I built it next to Bob Riffle's Pro Stock car. Needless to say, a few of those things that was done on Bob Riffle's car were done on my car.
I can imagine it. I can imagine.
So
yeah.
It was an extremely good car. And I kind of listened to Grumpy Jenkins a lot. And, you know, his little cute sayings he'd have. And he just, well, I think it was Smokey Unix said this, cheat 100 ways, you only find 50. You know? But I just tried to bend the rules the best I could to get away with it, and I was pretty successful.
Right.
So,
right.
I wouldn't say I was cheating. I met a guy from Ike Smith from California. I met him in, I don't know, way back in the late 60s, in Indianapolis. And he says, it ain't cheating. He says, till you get caught. He says, if you can do anything you want, because he was taking springs out of the back of his car, out of the seat and stuff, just lighting it up everywhere he could. I said, what are you doing? He says, well, I said, ain't that cheating? He says, nope, it ain't cheating. He says, it's scheming and conniving. He says, it's only cheating when you get caught. If you don't get caught, it's scheming and conniving.
Yep, okay, I like that. That's good.
So, and I never forgot that. And Ike Smith was the guy's name. I never forgot his name either on account of that, because he raced the Hudson at the time.
Okay, all right. Yeah.
Okay, like them Hudson Hornets, like this. I think it was Jack Clifford run them Hudson Hornets out of California.
Yeah, they were flatheads, and they had a couple two-barrel or one-barrel carburetors on them.
Yeah. Yeah, they were pretty fast. You know, in the day, because I had a friend that had a Hudson Hornet, and it, you know, that Hudson Hornet, if you pull up to a stoplight, you're going to get across the intersection before anybody next year because that cycle was fast in the first 2 years.
Yep.
I'm going way back down in history.
Yeah, that's back in the early 60s or late 50s there. Yeah,
but, you know, I've come up through all that, which is what makes it so exciting. I mean, I won the first race at my first national championship was the World Finals in 68. And I believe, I don't remember exactly, I think I went like 1486, 88 mile an hour or something like that. Which, you know, back in the day for a four-speed, two-barrel, 283 car, that was pretty quick. The best game weighed 3,700 pounds, something like that.
So, I just finished up an interview with Cal Method, and one of the things he told me that kind of stuck with me was back in that era, you know, this was, of course, pre-internet and pre-everything, and the whole idea of information just, there wasn't a lot of information out there. There wasn't a lot of parts you could buy. You pretty much had to make whatever you had, and you had to figure out a lot of things on your own. I mean, granted, he was in Washington, but you were in Michigan. Was that pretty much still the case when you were?
That was exactly the way it was. I mean, he told you exactly, because I made stuff in my car, and everybody would say, why don't you market this stuff? Why don't you market this stuff? I said, hey, it took me too long to learn this stuff. I didn't market it. I don't know how to do that. All I do is go fast. Well, consequently, Mr. Gasket marketed a lot of that stuff, and Moroso marketed a lot of that stuff. A lot of that stuff I engineered along with other people. Right. And, you know, they looked at it and says, hey, you know, there's a market for this, and they're going to sell it. So they actually copied a lot of the things I did. Or somebody else thought about it at the same time. I don't know which, but it looked to me at the time like they did what I was told to do, to market that. Well, I was too busy racing and trying to make the car go fast and to worry about marketing. You know, I didn't see how you could make any money marketing. It showed you how stupid I was. I thought I could make money racing. But, you know, I found out that, you know, marketing is when you sell something, you sell it over and over and over again. Eventually you make money. Anyway, and I always kind of kept it to myself, no matter what I did, and that was the reason, because I didn't want the Chevrolet guys and all them guys, you know, when I was running the racing car, I didn't want the Chevrolet guys to know what I was doing, and when I was running the Chevrolet, I didn't want the Chrysler guys to know what I was doing, you know, so I just like when they asked me what I did, you know, like I told you, when Copeland asked me how he made the car run fast, I said, I just built it like a Chevrolet. Well, that was a general answer, but it wasn't an exact answer. You know, it wasn't what he was looking for.
I think he probably wanted dimensions and part numbers, right?
Exactly. He didn't want a smart-ass kid's opinion of telling them not what he wanted to hear.
Right.
You know, I got that feeling, but I know how to just gave them enough stuff in front of them without telling them, or kind of telling, kind of sort of, but not exactly. You know, all the clearances and things that I ran things that were just unheard of at the time. It worked. So that's why I continued doing it. So, you know, I'd read the books and see what people are doing, and I'd do what they were doing. If it didn't work, I went the other way. But that, you know, a lot of times the other way worked. A lot of times the clearances they told you when they're building the motors were way too much. And I tightened them all up, and it made it the car last longer, the rims lasted longer because the pistons were flopping around so much, and it wasn't so tight that it slowed it down, but it was tight enough that it sealed the cylinder.
Okay.
Things like that.
Okay. All right. So one of the things that came out of the Cal Method thing was, this was back, I think it must have been like maybe 72 or something. He was running Duffy pistons, and he had just rerun the thing, and the motor wouldn't come around, and it was smoking like crazy. He was running a stainless ring in it. So he called Bob Duffy and said, you know, you got to send me a Molly ring. This thing just won't seal up slow. And Bob told him, here's what you need to do. And he basically told him how to put a vertical gas port in the piston. He said, there's only two other people that know about this. One is Bobby Warren, and the other is Dave Bortman. That ring a bell?
That's what Cal said.
That's
who told him that?
Said.
Oh, Duffy told him that.
Duffy, yeah.
Yeah, Bob Duffy, yeah. Bob Duffy. I never knew what happened. I know he's dead, but I don't know how he got dead. But all of a sudden, he just disappeared. He's from Red Bank, New Jersey, I believe. Anytime he talked to me, he was so excited to talk to me because he knew I was just a bundle of stuff, but he also knew I wasn't going to tell him much. he was right. There's things you can do that are okay.
Okay, all right, I understand.
Marty Barrett used to say when he had Teardog, he says, there ain't no in between. It's either right or it ain't right. He says, there ain't no in between. You know, and that's what he'd see something. And if they, and, you know, him and Jenkins, you know, or whatever it was, Jenkins' was his favorite thing was saying was, if it's not in the rule book, it's okay. So, yeah, like the guy that bought my Challenger, he disassembled that whole car to find out what it was about that car that made it better. And then he ran that in the Autorama in Detroit, and it had me to come up there. He was there. This guy was from Minnesota. I don't remember his name now, but I know he I think he raced an A-stock automatic, white Mopar, Albright or something. Albright.
Yeah, he's like a collector. I mean, he was a big Mopar collector, right? Right.
Yeah, and he put my stuff on display and showed pictures in place of all the stuff that was wrong with that car, you know, that made me look like a cheater. And, I mean, what I did was scheming and conniving, and he made me look like a cheater because he exposed all the stuff that I had that, you know, if they it's fine for them to take the car and see what they wanted, but you don't spread it around the country. This is the way it was. You put that in your intelligence bank and keep it to yourself. You know?
Right. Well, that was when the last maybe 6 or 7 years, I think that all was done. I think when he restored the car, wasn't it?
Yeah, because he ended up, he's the one that took it out to Las Vegas or wherever that place where they auctioned the cars off.
Oh, Barrett Jackson.
And it sold for $44,000. And that car ended up in either England. I think it ended up in England. It's either England or Switzerland. I don't remember which.
Okay.
But the person that owned that called me. I had a hard time understanding because an English person doesn't talk like an American English. You know?
Right.
So it's not the same language. So, but anyway, I talked to him for quite an extent, and he asked me a lot of questions. But anyway, I don't think he'll ever come back to the U.S., but that's where it ended up as far as I know. But, he called me, but he paid $44,000 for that car.
Yeah. I mean, for what that car did, that car was worth, in my mind at least, a lot more than $44,000. I mean, at least in my opinion.
But the car itself was built exactly like a pro stock car. Like I said, it was built next to the other car. Yeah, you know, I could tell all that now, but that doesn't mean I told you what I did.
No, I don't need to
tell you what I did. But you just know that I built it next to a pro stock car.
Right.
And the same thing that I had the mechanic working on my car helping me was the same guy that worked on Riffle's car. And I don't remember his name offhand, but you know, they were built 10 feet apart from each other and at the same time. So whatever he did to Bob's car, he did to my car. Sometimes you can draw a little bit in between the two.
Right. Well, some of these guys will have to listen to it 2 or 3 times maybe to pick some of this stuff up. But I mean, you were killer in NHRA for sure, but IHRA, you were really good in IHRA.
Yeah, what happened was Chrysler wanted me to race IHRA too. Well, I didn't have an IHRA car. My car, my Challenger, they didn't have a class for it in there because they ran formula stock.
Right.
So I bought that 67 Dodge Dart strictly for IHRA. So I had the IHRA car and an NHRA car.
Yep.
And I raced, and I won everything I could win at IHRA. I actually won as many national events in IHR as I did in NHR, which I think is around 18.
Yep.
And I was a driver of the year and all kinds of things. I was a Carcraft magazine driver of the year, mechanic of the year, and all kinds of different things. But getting back to that, so I had the dart I ran for a year or two, and then they adopted the classes so that the NHRA cars could fit in it. So yeah. Then I didn't need the dart anymore, so I sold the dart. And then I was able to race my Challenger. So then I sold the dart. The guy sold it to 28 years later. I bought it back for them. And I still have it.
Okay.
And then Vance Cummings raced it in Copstock.
Right, I remember that.
Okay, that's still my car. Vance has got it. He's building a motor for it now, a 340. We went together. I built a 340 foot with him, and he took it out. It ran real fast, but then it started slowing down. He fixed it. The cylinder walls went away because it wasn't a poured block. So he's presently building a motor for the 340, hoping that we can get to run it this year. Unless they get rid of this virus thing, there ain't going to be no races this year.
All right. Well, Vance brought the car to a couple of the Great Lakes races. I think one up in mid-Michigan. I spent some time looking at the car, and it is absolutely beautiful. That car is nicely detailed.
Oh, yeah. He actually didn't have wheelie bars on it. It had all four wheels off the ground one time, and when he came down, it kind of messed the car all up. And I told my son at the time, I didn't actually see it. My son saw it. He said, man, he really bowed that car up. I said, one thing about it, I said, the type of work Vance does, that's fine, because he'll fix it so it's just as good, if not better, than it was new. And he did.
Yeah.
Because he does a fantastic job.
I was at Milan when he was running Top Stock the day he put that thing on the bumper. And I still can remember seeing that thing. That thing was nearly vertical.
Oh, yeah. I'll tell you what, that guy, he's so timid to talk to and talk so low and slow. But you know, there's a monster behind the eyes. He's like a Jekyll and Hyde when he gets in the race car.
Okay.
You know, he's real timid when he gets behind the wheel. Look out, because he's a bad old brain.
Yeah.
And he
ain't
afraid to put it on the bumper 10 times a row if you want.
So he did it.
I don't like to do that because it causes too much damage when it comes down.
Right.
I did that time, and that's why I never want to do that again. I run the 8th mile on the rear wheels one time. That was I was racing for Dick Sherman. I had his car rather than Super Stock C automatic with the Camaro.
Right.
And we had about a 50-mile-an-hour headwind at Commerce, Georgia. And the thing went up in the air, And actually, I was racing against
Rock Running.
Yeah, I was running against him at the time, and I beat him. And I says, did you look at your mirror and see the show going on behind you? He says, no, why is that? I said, because I went all the way to the 8th mile on the rear wheels. I says, and I kept looking out both side windows, and as long as I could see a guardrail on one side and a center line on the other, I said, it kept her going, and it finally came down, and I won the race.
That's great.
But he had about a 40-mile-an-hour headwind, so once it went up, it was like a sail. It just stayed up.
Right.
You know, it's funny, but things like that, you remember, you don't forget things
right.
like that.
Yeah. So you did the Chrysler thing, then you came back and Rod Schopf got with you again to do the Firebird.
Yeah, in 85.
Okay.
So the Firebird was a turnkey operation because it was Larry Morgan's car in 84.
Okay.
So in 85, they asked me if I wanted to run the Fiero, or if I wanted to run the Trans Am. And I told him I'd prefer to run the Trans Am because I didn't want to, at that time of my life, I was old enough that I didn't want to work as hard as I did when I was younger.
Right,
I decided,
right.
Well, if I'm going to race, I'm just going to mostly drive. So that's when I went back with them, that was the deal, was that I mostly just drove and I didn't build my engines or nothing at that time. So this was a turnkey deal and I jumped into Larry Morgan's car.
Okay.
I ended up building motors for it eventually, but not right away. And that's what happened in 85, 86, and 7. And that was the end of it.
Okay. And so 85, you were...
World champion then.
Yeah, world champion. Okay, yeah.
So that was my fifth world championship then. And I can't even tell you how many times I won a division because I don't remember. All I know is I got five world championships and 17 national championships.
So pretty impressive record over the years.
Yeah. Like I told you before, I think I told you last time, when they called me and wanted me to do a... somebody called me from NHRA, and this is, probably 30 years ago. They wanted me to do a resume on my stuff, and I think I told you about it. I made a resume, and I said, no one person could possibly do all this stuff. But I did. At that time, I looked it all up. I don't even know where I'd find all that stuff now, because it's been so many years. But it was just unbelievable what I did.
I mean, to hit all the races you did and win as much, I mean, you had to be nonstop on the road.
Oh, yeah. Well, for instance, back in 71, which is my best year, like I said, I won more races than I lost. That's the actual best year I've ever had in my life. And at the time, I'd won, I was racing the points races, and I was racing all of them, okay? And at the time, I'd raced 8 points races and won 7 of them. And the only reason I lost the 8th one is I broke the rear end on the starting line.
Yep.
On the final run. And that was a bet against Bob Burkett.
Yeah, okay.
And I broke it on the final run. No, the final run wasn't against Bob Burkett. I had to re-race Bob Burkett 3 times because they had 3 dead heats between me and Bob Burkett. Now, that guy was hard to beat. I told you Bobby Ward's hard to beat. Burkett was even harder to beat. So I mean, he was in my division. Bob,
right, he ran the wagon, the behemoth, right?
Yeah, the behemoth.
Yep.
And then on the final run, I broke the rear end right on the starting line. So never moved. So anyway, that was just phenomenal that I won that. What was funny about that deal is I'd won, one of the races I won was on the East Coast, and I don't remember which track it was. That was the next year because the guy that bought the behemoth, I ran, raced him in the final there and I beat him. Okay. So I raced this guy with my Charger in 71 at
ATCO.
ATCO.
Yep.
Yeah, I rode and raced ATCO one time, and that was it. I raced the guy that bought the behemoth in the final, and he wanted me to lose so that he could qualify for the world finals. I told him, I says, hey, I says, I'd like to do that. I says, but, when you pull the line, you're going to have to race me. I says, because I don't give races away. He said, well, you won so much, you can give me one. I said, I ain't giving none. And I didn't. I beat him. It kind of irritated me that he even asked me to do that,
Yeah,
but,
right.
But, when you're there to race, you're not there to give a race away. That's not why you're there.
Yeah.
I probably saved the time of driving out to qualify or not qualify or whatever, So I might have done him a favor. I'd like to think I did. I don't want to think I was a rat about it, but that wasn't the first time I'd been asked to do that. Roy Johnson out of Amarillo did that once to me when I stopped at Amarillo on the way to California and won a race. Of course, I was up until 4 in the morning putting together a motor because I flew the motor the day before. but I won that race, but with a new motor that I went to California with. But I used to carry motors with me, but that was when I had time to build them. You don't have time to do all that stuff now.
Right.
So,
You were one of the first really true touring sportsman racers, right? A professional sportsman racer? Full-time racing. Weren't you back in the early 70s there?
Yes. I was the only one that did that. Okay. And I was the only one that ever made a living that doing it. And that's what I did. And I was just, it was just my time, my era. And, the guys out there now are fantastic, but they're all you know, if you ever took their computers away, I don't know how good they'd be. But right. I never raced that way. I still race in the seat of my pants.
Okay. Okay.
Because I was successful doing that, so I couldn't see doing it, changing it.
Right.
Which I don't know if that's good or bad, but it's my story and I'm sticking to it.
Well, you know, Cal Method made the same thing. Virtually the same exact comment. He said, you know, the days before the all the times, incremental times on the time slip and all the information age, you had to work hard at it and you earned it.
Oh, yeah. He was good. He was tough. I didn't know him that well because he was way out on the West Coast. But I watched him and kept track of him very carefully, and I would never give him any slack, I'll tell you that. Because he'd have to work for it. You know,
so,
and back then, the funny thing was, you kind of knew who you had to race and who you could just kind of slide by. And nowadays, you know, 128 car field, any one of them 128 could win.
Right.
You know, there's no advantage because, you know, it's all against the number you put on the window. And that's bracket racing. I just feel like I had a very expensive bracket car. Because it wasn't the same, you know. You used to get notoriety for doing well, you know, just like Jerry Stahl did, and, you know, Duffy knew all them guys from East Coast and all that. You know, all them guys, Joe Scott, they all worked their butt off and tried to outperform the same as I did.
Yeah. You mentioned Bobby Warren, you mentioned Bob Burkett, they were tough. Who else, I mean, back, who were the ones that you knew that you had to be up on the wheel when they were near the lane?
They were kind of quitting when I was starting up. The other ones was the Chevere Racing team.
Okay.
On Lansing, you know, with the old man in there, I forgot his name now.
Dick Griffin?
Dick Griffin. And Bill Haynes and all them guys with the Chevere Racing team. In fact, when I started racing this class, the other one that was a Chevere was, what was his name?
John Callender.
Honest John was anything but Honest John. In fact, he made it kind of rough on me a couple of times because he went around telling everybody that he knew I was cheating because he was cheating. He got away with it, so he knew I had to be cheating, too.
Okay.
And that wasn't the truth. The way he was cheating, I finally found out, he ran a Pontiac two-barrel on this car. I never did that.
Okay.
So, you know, I made my two-barrel. I think that Pontiac was an inch and a quarter. Mine was an inch and 3/32. And I made that thing work. And, okay. He of course, when he made his work, he worked about 2/10 quicker than me.
Right.
But anyway, he had a long curve here. But he didn't do me any favors by making that statement. But it made it look really, really bad for me, even though, you know, they never caught me doing anything like that.
Yeah.
But I'm telling you right now, I didn't have a Pontiac carburetor. I sure wanted to put one on. I caught Roger Ahol with a Pontiac carburetor. I knew how to tell him.
Okay.
You could take a pen. Was it a pen or a pencil? All you had to do, you didn't have to look down there. You take a pen or a pencil and shove it down the Venturi. If it went through, it was a Pontiac. If it didn't go through, it was Chevrolet.
Okay.
If anybody ever turned their back on me for a second, I was looking at the carburetor. Before they turned their back, I could have a pencil in and out of that thing. It was either a pencil or a pen. I don't remember which one it was now. But anyway, that's all I could tell. Because once I found out John Callender did that, I had to figure out how to find out who was doing it. And Roger Ahol set the record, and I caught him with the wrong carburetor. And they give him the record. They threw him out, too, but they still give him the record.
Little
Roger Ahol.
I remember Bill Haynes telling me one time that you know, you would take what other people would throw away and make it run faster than anybody thought it would go.
Okay. Yeah, because he's always pulling the stuff out of the garbage can. People threw away. You know, before I was, I just wanted to look at what they did he said, well, if you want to, I'll take it and make it work in my car. And I didn't always, but I'd always check to see what they were doing to see if I was missing something.
Yeah.
That's what I do. If they threw it away, you can bet your life it's going in my truck. Go home to check it. Hey, that's what you learn, you know?
Yeah, right.
You know, you learn if they're cheating. You learn if they got something to get away with, you know. And that it's all in the game. It's just a game that we play.
Yeah.
You know?
Okay.
And, you know,
yeah.
We used to have a lot of fun playing these games. Now, what they do, they throw you $2,000 or $3,000 fine on you and stuff stupid like that.
Yeah.
If they ever fined me, I'd have been done racing right then because, that ain't the way I was brought up. We had a lot of fun, you know.
So how about, I got to believe winning the World Finals 68 was probably one of your highlights. I mean, what other were wins or other events over the years, I mean, that still stick with you today and put a smile on your face?
I guess the biggest win would be the one at the U.S. Nationals when I raced the coal digger in the final round, Don Bowles.
Yep.
Because he was running a class up from me. Heads up, I couldn't beat him. Let's put it that way. I had to spot him a tenth of a second. I spotted him a tenth of a second. Okay? And I said to my wife before I ran, I says, there's no way in hell I could beat him. I says, he can beat me heads up, and he's a tenth of a second faster than me. And she says, just go do the best you can.
Yep.
So I did that. I'm just going to mow the tree down. And they did have reaction timers set. I guess that's the one I remember the most because that was the one I knew there was no way possible I was going to win.
Yeah.
And he stayed the car. He, of course, he had one of the Ford motor, the Pro Stock guy built his motor.
Thing or something he had, right? Jack Roush. Is that Jack Roush?
Roush, yeah. Jack Roush built the motor for him.
Yeah.
And I just knew that there was no way I could beat him. So we pulled up there and I staged and the lights came down and I dropped the hammer on it, and I said, shit, I knew I redlined it. I just knew I redlined it. I looked at my damn light was green. And I said, I don't believe I got away with that light. I'm thinking it's going all the way down the track. I'm going down the track, and that was in the final round. You go as fast as you can, they go against the end first, but no matter what, wins. And I was running against Don Bowles. And I got to the final, and my wind light come on, and he come flying by me. And we went to the scales, and I says, I thought for sure. I said to him, I thought for sure you were going to beat me. He says, yeah, I did too. He says, I don't know how you beat me. He says, you shouldn't have beat me. And I looked, and he says, what's wrong with your car, Don? I looked at his car. It was leaning over to one side. Right. He walked around and looked. He says, son of a bitch. He says, I got a flat tire. He says, that's why I didn't catch you. He says, the tire was going flat. And I said to him, I said, Don, I'm sorry. I says, but you know why your tire went flat? He says, no, why? I says, because I knocked the tree over so bad, the glass fell in your lane, and you've got a flat tire. he was so pissed off, he went back to Roush and said, build me a modified motor. I've never raced Bortman again. He's a pretty successful racer, but he's never, ever beat me. Never. And we raced a lot of times because we raced, you know, the same division in stock.
Right.
And he says, I've never raced him again. So that's what he did. He raced modified for a couple of years and then he quit. But,
that's classic. That's great.
That's the one that stands out the most because pulling the line, I knew there was no way in hell I was going to win. And, you know, even according to the numbers, I spotted him a tenth. His lights came down first and I left in front of him. When I left in front of him, I thought, holy shit, what happened? You know, and like I said, shit, I redlined it. I looked in it was green. But I left ahead, and I thought, how did I leave ahead of him? He was supposed to leave first. So, anyway, so there's a few races like that you just never forget.
Yeah, that's great.
That wasn't even a world championship. That was the U.S. Nationals, that was my second U.S. Nationals. You know, not too many people won the U.S. Nationals twice.
Right.
I won it in 70 with my 69 Chevy, and then that year was against Don Bowles, and of course we were in Superstock then. So I think that was 77.
Okay.
I think that was, or 76. I don't remember.
Okay.
I won the World Finals in 77. I think that was 76 Nationals. But anyway.
Right. I remember, there's all these pictures you see out on the internet. It's you at Ontario Motor Speedway with the Challenger going through the traps with the front tires smoking, locking them up.
I think that was the one that was against that California guy. What was his name?
I'll have to find the picture and find it. But all I remember is the Rideshaft car, your car going across the finish line, the nose down on the ground, and the front tires just smoke pouring off them.
And that wasn't the one against the guy from Washington, was it?
Yeah.
I got a picture of the one at Pomona where both cars got smoke come off the tires.
Yep.
Okay, if that's the one, that wasn't at Ontario, that was at Pomona.
Okay, all right, okay.
What was the guy's name? Superstock D. Very great for some Ford dealership up there.
Van Cleve?
Yeah.
Right.
That was against Van Cleve.
And he had the white car.
Yeah.
Yep.
That was the other one, too. Yeah, he went farther below than I did, and I got there first. We're both sliding the brakes. they thought that we crashed because there was so much smoke down there, and we just disappeared in the clouds. We supposed to be gone. They thought we crashed. And everybody thought we crashed because what's that going on now or something? I don't know. I didn't hear what he said until I was in the car. Yeah, that was against Ken Van Cleve?
Jim Van Cleve,
that's right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right. Yeah.
I think
yeah.
I pinned on him, I think.
Yeah.
Never raced him.
Yeah.
But anyway. Yeah.
Along the way, is there anybody that you want to say thanks to or that really kind of helped you out along the way?
Well, actually, Gil Kirk and Jim Thompson from the Rod Shop. Jim Thompson, if it wasn't for him, I would never be as smart as I am now. Because he taught me a lot of things. And I'm sure I taught him a lot of things. When I built my motors, he called it a barnyard hat, crosshatch. Because these guys are building that real fine 400, and I put that 280 in a Larry Rip. Yeah, those two guys, Jim Thompson ran the Rod Shop and Gil Kirk owned it. You know, I'd say that, you know, I'd have never been as successful as I was if them and Chrysler Dodge Corporation had given me the opportunity. You know,
yeah.
All I ever wanted to do was prove to them that I was as good as I could be all the time, you know, and I had so much appreciation for letting me have the ability to do it, you know, on my own, sort of on my own terms, helping me out and stuff, you know, that I just felt indebted to him all the time. I didn't feel like I ever earned it, so I had to show that I appreciated it, I guess. I don't know, whatever. You figure that out.
it showed in the way you, I mean, what you delivered. It certainly showed.
Yeah, I was just so happy. You know, and everybody used to say, always say how lucky I was to be able to do that. But I felt like I had to show them by winning every time I pulled in the starting line. Show that I deserved what I got.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, that does a lot for a person, you know. You're attaboys, you know.
Yeah,
because I had dealings with people that just put me down and stuff, and you know, I never wanted $1 million or anything like that. I just wanted an attaboy. Getting back to the Pontiacs, you know what? I'd been out of the car for 8 years, and I went to the first races in Pomona in '85 with Larry Morgan's old car, the Trans Am, got all the way down to the final round. And every time I'd run, Bitch Lee would come up and check see my slip and see what my reaction time was. I didn't know what a reaction time was. Finally, I said, what's your reaction time? Because, you know, they didn't have it when I raced before. You know,
yeah.
And he says, well, it's right on your slip. I said, what does that mean? He says, well, according to your reaction time, that's a pretty good reaction time. I says, well, that's why I've always driven. I said, that's usually, I says, I could tell when to do that. I says, well, like the time, just like I told you about the time against Don Bolin. Bolin, yeah. They didn't have reaction time there, but I had to believe 500 was perfect. I had to believe that that would have been a 500 light. Actually, I would have thought it would be closer to 490, but actually, it's probably a 500 light. And, you know, you didn't have that. Now, when he started coming up and looking at my ET slips, they were, 20s, 30s, 520s, 530s, which at that time, you know, when they just started using the reaction time, that was a good reaction time. That's the way I'd always driven.
Yeah.
So that's as far as I can remember anyway.
Right.
So I knew that I was cutting better lights than anybody else. Well, just like when I raced Bulls. He was supposed to leave a full tenth of a second ahead in front of me, and I left first.
Yeah.
I mean, and I knew I left first. So, and I got there first. So, anyway, yeah. And so then I started paying attention to reaction times. And the other thing that hurt me is, they had the five amber lights. And what I would do is I get myself set up for them coming down. And I pick up the rhythm. You know, it's just like playing in the band, you know.
Yeah.
And I'd get the rhythm going. And when I went to the three bulb lights, it really screwed me up. Because I couldn't get the rhythm with three lights.
Okay.
I wasn't used to it. I used to five lights. But, you know, that it is what it was, you know. And I do fair with it, but I still didn't do as good as I do with five lights.
Yeah.
But just a different rhythm set. But, you know, like I say, I didn't know about that until Butch Leal told me.
Great.
From the time I started, if I couldn't, it was, all I wanted to do was make payments. You know, as far as, first of all, I just wanted to make enough money to pay the entrance fee. And then got a little hungry, and I thought, well, how about the entrance fee and the gas money? And then, you know, pretty soon I thought, well, if I put any more into the car, I'd like to pay for that instead of just throwing money away. So I always tried to do it like a business, you know, without being stupid and still having fun, which I was able to do. I had chances to go pro stock racing, and that didn't excite me at all because I couldn't see working that hard for the little bit of reward you get. I wasn't willing to put in that much for it because I was still trying to be a family man of some sort too, you know.
Right.
Instead of just a racing nut. But you got to just draw your line in the sand and stick to it. As long as I can have fun and make a little money, I was happy with it. Getting back to the very beginning, the reason I started running the Nationals and that was because I found out that going down there just to be a spectator, it cost me more to be a spectator than it did to get in. And if I at that time you paid $25 to get in the Nationals back. Well, I take that back. It was $30 back for the Nationals, $25 for the other beats. And back then you go there and you get oil and you get T-shirts and you get SCP and all this stuff that the manufacturers give you.
Right.
And you get two pit passes with it and all the stuff that they give you. The one thing I liked about running stock back then was whenever they had oil down, they run the stockers. So they put the oil down, run the stockers, so we'd clean up the oil mess for them. And now that they had all this track equipment, sprayed the whole track and everything, they don't let us do that anymore. We only get two runs in each race and otherwise forget it.
So when a fueler blew a motor, it was stocked to the lanes and they ran you guys to clean up the oil dry.
Oh, yeah. They just put the oil dry down and then bring the stockers out. So I used to go to national events to make six, seven runs. Are you kidding me? Six or seven runs?
Right.
You know? So it's just a whole different deal. It's just,
I think the way you explain stuff, you know, that you really wanted just to do a really good job for Rod Stop and Chrysler, that's really good. I mean, that'll stick with people. I know it surely will stick with me.
Yeah, I mean, I was just so excited to do that because, you know, when Gil Kirk called me, he said, I got a fantastic deal for you, one that you can't refuse. I said, yeah, well, we'll see. So he had me come down to Columbus. He wanted me to come to Columbus, talk to him one-on-one. So I came down there, and 2 weeks later, I was leaving for California for the race. Yeah, and I, like I said, I found out later on that Kofel said that that was a, would be a seat in his behalf if he could get me in there, because I'd won enough that I'd been a big pain in their ass is what it was for so long. You know, because even with, well, Burkett was driving a Dodge or a Plymouth, whatever, Plymouth, I think it was. But anyway, yeah. It's Chrysler product. And, you know, I beat him several times. And, boy, he was hard to beat, but he was good. And you know, so, and then I won Indy in 70. Of course, then at the same time I won Indy, Bill Kirk's trying to make a deal with Chrysler. And lo and behold, who wins it? Bortman did again. You know, Bortman won the World Finals in 68. And then in 70, let's see what I won in 69. Not too much. I won the division again.
Yeah. But 70, you won the Summer Nationals before you won Indy.
That's right. Yeah. Cause me and Ron Mancini both won the Summer Nationals and Indy.
Yeah.
And Ron, I'd never talked to Ron Mancini before. But he was in the winner's circle. I congratulated him. I was in the winner's circle. He congratulated me. I saw him at Indy. It was the next race I saw him at. I said to him, you ready to do it again? I said to Ron, he says, I'm ready if you're ready. I said, well, let's do it then. You know, just bullshitting.
Right.
We damned if we didn't both do it again. But, yeah, so anyway, that was pretty exciting there.
Okay, so Dave, you ran your wife, I think at least once, maybe twice, when you guys were running the Stockers, you in the Charger and her in the wagon. So she beat you once. So what was the story behind that?
Actually, it was kind of intentional because Dave Kofel told me if I ever raced her at a final in a major event, that if I would beat her, it would be a mistake because at the time I was winning everything, so it kind of looked better that she would have won. And I had winner and runner-up sold up there at that Ignacio beat in 71. So I kind of intentionally redlined to make sure she didn't because she left first.
And that, I mean, that would have to be a pretty big deal for, that was one of the few women that had won a national event at that time. And I'm sure, I guess, the Rod Shop and Chrysler had to be happy about that.
Yeah, actually, Julie Lilly had won a race, but other than that, my wife had won the second race, you know, national event. So, it was kind of a feather in our hat in the Rod Shop, and it turned out real good.
I think I told you this when we talked the other day, but, you know, I listened to your words talking about how appreciative you were of having the opportunity to run for the Rod Shop and how hard you tried.
Yeah, that's absolutely true, too, because that just made me better than I was, you know. In my day, I was top, but that made me even better. And see, the first year I raced was 71, and that was like I told you before, it was an unbelievable year. I won more races than I lost, and it's mostly because it was just such a feather in my cap every time I won, and I kind of reacted to it. It's like I told you, a pat on the back.
Yep.
You know, it wasn't so much for the money or anything, as it much for the pat on the back, you know, to tell somebody I did a good job. There's nothing to compare with, you know, what a pat on the back will do for a person as far as, you know, them responding and, you know, doing a good job. You know, and everything I've ever done in my life, I've always done with that idea. It wasn't, sure, the money's nice, but the pat on the back is something you never forget. You forget about the money.
No, that's
you spend it and it's gone, but you remember the pat on the back.
Yeah, I mean, I tell you, that's living proof of how powerful gratitude can be, right?
Oh yeah. I mean, nothing's better. You know, winning is great, but the pat on the back for winning, you know, goes a lot farther than the actual win, I believe.
Yeah.
So
Dave, I want to thank you for taking the time to share some of your life experiences, your racing experiences, and some great stories, and really appreciate you taking the time.
Yeah, okay, no problem. I'm glad to do it. Glad to remember people remember me yet from way back when, because I had a lot of fun racing and did well, and I'm happy I did it, and glad to let everybody else know just kind of what the deal was. So, yeah, thank you for calling and doing the story on me. I appreciate it.
Okay. Thanks, Dave. I hope you enjoyed these great stories from Dave. If you like these podcasts, please be sure to hit the follow button, and we welcome your comments on what you would like to hear about in future episodes. Thanks for listening.